Welcome to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'll be joined in just a few minutes by my co-host, Jen Chavez. Jen is visiting with filmmakers Lindsay Graizel and Dea Schlossberg. They were arrested last fall for reporting on fossil fuel resistance at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Now they're putting together a documentary called The Reluctant Radical. And I'll be talking with Beth Federici, director of The American Master's Profile of James Beard, America's First Foodie. But first, let's welcome back to the studio Eric Slade. He's just produced a whirlwind overview of the animation scene that's been happening in and around Portland. It's called Oregon's Animation Magic. Eric, it's great to see you again.
Hey, thanks for having me back again. I appreciate it.
Well, at the top of the show, we heard a snippet of music from one of the short films mentioned in Oregon's Animation Magic, Photocopy Cha-Cha. Both the music and the animation were composed by Shell White of Bent Image Lab. Bent is one of the local studios, along with Leica, that have made Portland a hub for stop-motion animation, the sort of work we see in The Nightmare Before Christmas and the Wallet and Gromit series.
That's right. And, you know, last fall, we started working on a 30-minute special about animation in Oregon for Oregon Artbeat on OPB, and we had no idea how big it is. I knew animation was big here, but it's huge. Here's a couple of factoids for you. There's 4 Oscars that have been given to Oregonians. All of them have been to animators. The other piece is that there are 2 places in the world that are considered stop motion capitals of the world, as it were. One of them is Bristol, England, home of Wallace and Gromit, but the other is right here in Portland, Oregon. So yeah, it's a big, big scene here, and that's when we got into it. We were really surprised and excited to be telling this story.
Well, there was a big premiere screening at the Portland Art Museum last week you hosted, and many of the local legends were there. Rose Bond, who is just a longtime person who does animation installations all over the world. Oscar winners, as you said, Joan Gratz and Will Vinton, among others.
Yeah, and we had a couple of people from Leica, Brian Lowry and Nelson Lowry, sorry, and Brian McLean. So it was an amazing time. And actually, those 6 animators said they'd never been on stage before together. So it was an exciting night, yeah.
Yeah, during the Q&A session right after the premiere, somebody in the audience asked what was the secret to the vital animation scene in Portland, and the immediate answer was low rents. That was the case in the 20th century, the late 20th century. The cost of living is very different now, but animation is still here.
Right. And I think there are several answers to that question. And one of them was Will Vinton, of course. I mean, Will started this whole scene, but it wasn't just Will. It was a whole bunch of other people. There was the Animation Collective that Jim Blashfield helped form back in the 70s. There was a place to learn animation in the Northwest Film Center. There were grants. And then there was all the rain that drove everybody inside. And what else do you do when you're inside? You animate.
Well, what you just said about community is so true. It's like there's so much of an exchange of knowledge and just a friendliness. I can remember just being in a bar somewhere when I first moved to Portland from Chicago, and here's Shell White and Bill Plimpton and Joan Gratz and Joanna Priestley, and it's like, oh my God, all my heroes from Alive from Off Center and Night Flight and all those shows from the 80s.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I heard over and over again is if you travel somewhere else in the animation world and you mention Portland, everyone goes, ooh, Portland. Like, they all know about it. And one of the testaments to that is that Shadow Machine is a big animation company in L.A. They make BoJack Horseman, all these animated series. They recently just moved a branch to Portland with 60 people. So Portland's not only a big space, animation space in the history here, but it's getting bigger and bigger. So it's a great story. We premiere tonight on OPB at 8 p.m. on OPB TV, and I hope people will tune in. We also have a really rich site online that has the whole show playing, streaming there, but also a whole bunch of deeper pieces that we did on animation in Oregon. So, you know, check it out tonight on OPB, and also go to the website. It's opb.org/animation.
That's Oregon's Animation Magic as part of the Artbeat series. Eric Slade, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You are tuned in to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and in a few minutes, I'll be talking with Beth Federici. Beth has just completed a biopic about the legendary Portland chef James Beard, and it'll be airing as part of the American Masters series. Right now, though, let's talk with my co-host, Jen Chavez. Jen is visiting with filmmakers Lindsay Graizel and Dea Schlossberg.
The documentary The Reluctant Radical, currently in production, follows Oregon climate activist Ken Ward. Ken's nonviolent direct actions against the fossil fuel industry have had many venues, from boats to train tracks to gas stations to the site of the Trans Mountain Pipeline in Washington last fall. His actions there were part of a coordinated effort by climate activists to shut down tar sands oil pipelines across the country. And they got him arrested and charged with felonies carrying decades of potential prison time. What's more, documentary filmmakers covering the actions, including Lindsay Grazel in Washington and Dea Schlossberg in North Dakota, were similarly arrested and charged. Well, 6 months later, Lindsay and Dea have now joined forces to finish the film about Ken Ward, and the three of them will be at Portland's Hollywood Theater with the Portland Eco Film Festival tonight at 7:30 to show scenes from The Reluctant Radical and to discuss climate activism and First Amendment rights for journalists and filmmakers. Lindsay and Dea join me at KBOO to talk more. Lindsay and Dea, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Could you start by telling us a little bit about Ken Ward and the type of guy he is?
Yeah, Ken is a really compelling character. He has worked as an insider in environmental activist circles, like high up leading national organizations and state organizations in the PERG family and also Greenpeace. He had a career doing that for about 20 years before taking some time off, raising his son, and reading more and more about climate change and getting more and more disturbed about the depth of the crisis. And having firsthand knowledge of how environmental groups were going about trying to bring change about, he felt like they needed to seriously step back and retool their approach. And he pushed hard for that and didn't get anywhere. And over a period of years came to the realization that he thought civil disobedience was the most effective political tool. I've been making a film about him since summer of 2015, following some of his direct actions and the motivations and how he got to where he is today.
I was fortunate enough to have seen a few scenes, and you'll be showing those at the upcoming event. And one thing that struck me as interesting is how Ken talks about feeling like nobody's listening to him or taking his alarm about climate change seriously, to the degree that he's at one point, I believe, diagnosed with a mental disorder. Is that sense of isolation something that's common or that either of you see in climate activism or with people concerned with climate change?
Absolutely. I know I've experienced something similar to that, and most people that I work with in the climate movement at some point or another struggle with that. It is the cognitive dissonance of understanding the facts and the reality and living in a world that isn't responding appropriately.
Mm-hmm. And it was actually that story of him having that experience with this psychiatrist that prompted me to say, oh my gosh, I need to make a film with Ken as the character.
Really?
Because to me it's emblematic of, you know, to say that you're delusional because you're concerned that civilization could come to an end because of the conditions of the planet. When actually, you know, we have a planet of 7 billion people, 99% of them are going about as if life is just happening on a day-to-day basis and not really paying too much attention to it. It's, I think, reasonable to say that it's the rest of the world that's delusional in that sense, not the people who are actually hollering that we need to step up and take action.
Mm-hmm. So another scene, probably a crucial scene, actually, is it shows Ken in a yellow vest and a hard hat with some bolt cutters preparing for a direct action. It was part of a coordinated shut it down action at several locations across the country in October of 2016. Can you tell us about that day and how it reverberated in Ken's life and in your lives?
Sure. So the shut it down actions, they were coordinated actions. There were five activists spread out across four locations, and they shut down all five tar sands pipelines coming into the country from Canada. So Ken was part of that coordinated direct action, and I was filming him along with my cameraman in the state of Washington as he went to shut down the Trans Mountain pipeline. I can't speak for Ken in terms of all of the ramifications for him. He should speak himself about that, and he'll actually be at the Hollywood on Thursday night, and you can hear from him directly about how that's affected him.
And for you, there were ramifications for both of you as well. Could you tell us about how you were impacted as filmmakers?
Yeah, I was covering the action in North Dakota on the shutdown of the Keystone Pipeline on that same day. And when the police came and arrested the activists, they arrested me as well. And I learned later that they arrested other filmmakers, journalists that were also covering the action in the other locations. But at the time, I didn't know any of that was going on, and it was just a total shock to be arrested for doing my job. I mean, I knew that there was a risk of arrest, like in the moment, the police not being super clear on just what exactly was going on. And even though I made sure to be completely legal in all my actions and told them I was part of the media and that was within my rights, I was still arrested. That wasn't a total shock because journalists get mixed up in actions. What was the complete shock were the 3 felony charges. And I don't think any of us were at all ready for that.
And you were charged with felonies as well, Lindsay, is that right?
Yeah, myself and my cameraman were charged with the same crimes that Ken was charged with, 3 felonies and 1 misdemeanor. For me, you know, in the moment of being arrested, it's really scary, and you realize that there's a huge intimidation factor when the police or just a single sheriff can decide, oh, I'm just going to throw this person in jail and we'll figure it out later. But the long-term consequence, once I've sort of settled down, got back to Portland, my community totally rallied behind me, the International Documentary Association, the ACLU. And so having that institutional support was huge for me, and also having just the support of my colleagues in town, knowing that I was going to get through this and we were going to fight it and we were going to win, of course. So, mm-hmm. And in the end, I think it's beautiful that through this process, Stay and I have decided to work together. I feel more committed than ever to telling this story and more drawn to do this work now. So,
can you tell us anything more about the process of the film going forward?
In terms of a completion date, where it's a little bit of a moving target. He actually has a trial still coming up on May 22nd that I'll be filming. And so a lot will depend on if there are surprises that happen at that trial. He's already been tried once and had a hung jury was a result of that first trial. So it was declared a mistrial and the prosecutor's trying again. But that hung jury was pretty, it was an amazing moment because the whole trial, he is describing what he did, why he did it. He is not disputing any of the evidence. In fact, they put forth some evidence of their own in terms of the video footage that I took was actually supplied by the defense, and then the prosecutor used it in their arguments. And despite that evidence, the jury refused to convict him. So we may get another surprise on May 22nd. That would be fabulous. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if that happens, it will, you know, change my editing timeline. But I certainly hope to have this finished up this summer.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about the climate movement as well. Portland is going to be one of many cities across the country with climate marches happening this weekend. And obviously the climate is becoming a more important and more contentious issue under the Trump administration. What do you see for the future of the climate movement? For example, will we see more direct actions like Ken's under Trump or more mass demonstrations like this weekend?
I think more of everything. Like Lindsay was saying, isolation is a very effective tactic of climate deniers, making people think that they're the only one that believes this crazy thing. I mean, that's something that Ken struggled with. That's something that we experienced when they jailed us. But once you connect with the whole community and really understand that, no, there's actually a majority of people that knows that the science is real and this is happening, and that's a really fortifying phenomenon. And I think the more these mass actions happen, marches and acts of civil disobedience, the more people will feel empowered to stop questioning themselves and act according to what they believe.
Any more info that either of you would like to share about tonight's event that's, again, filming the fossil fuel resistance at the Hollywood Theater?
Well, we hope a lot of people will come out and join us. We're going to have an exciting panel discussion afterwards with ourselves. Ken Ward will be there, and also my lawyer. And also, we just launched a Kickstarter to help us fund post-production costs for music, a post-sound mix, and color correction. And so we'll be sharing that information, and anyone who wants to make a donation can go to bit.ly/reluctantradical and find our Kickstarter page there.
Thank you both very much for speaking to me. Today I've been speaking with documentary filmmakers Lindsay Graizel and Daya Schlossberg. Thank you very much both for speaking with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jen. And Jen Chavez was talking with Lindsay Graizel and Dea Schlossberg. Again, a rough cut of their new documentary, The Reluctant Radical, will be presented as part of the Portland Eco Film Festival this evening at the Hollywood Theater. And we have two pairs of tickets here to give away for that screening. If you are lucky callers number 2 and 4, those tickets can be yours. The number to call is 503-231-8032. Filmmakers Lindsay Graizel and Dea Schlossberg will be in attendance at this evening's rough cut of The Reluctant Radical at the Hollywood Theater and will be leading a Q&A session. Again, the number to call to win yourself a pair of tickets is 503-231-8032. And now we are joined in the studio by Beth Federici, director of the film America's First Foodie, The Incredible Life of James Beard. It'll be airing as part of the American Masters biography series on public television next month. Beth, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, James Beard has become an icon in American culinary circles, but even some Oregonians are not aware that he's originally one of us.
That is true. He was born here in Portland in 1903 and lived over here in the Southeast. And yeah.
Well, the film that you put together, it begins in New York at the Lincoln Center in the present day, where you get to rub elbows with all these celebrity chefs. Many of them have won themselves a James Beard Foundation Award. I guess others are still waiting for their turn.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, one major thread that runs through your film is that James Beard had the curse of being constantly ahead of his time. He was a non-closeted gay student at Reed College in the 1920s. He was an expatriate in Paris before that was cool. Yeah, but most importantly, he was creating recipes with food that was locally sourced and sustainable back in the age of Duncan Hines and Betty Crocker.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think his childhood here in Portland at the turn of the century, when everything was local and regional, because that's all that there was.
And the Northwest had an amazing bounty of, you know, fish and grains and crops and berries.
Exactly. And the Yamhill Farmers Market was, it was really the Yamhill Public Market, because it was more than just farmers. You could get anything you wanted there. It was the supermarket of its day. And his mother was very versed and knew all the vendors. And so he had a pretty incredible childhood, and I think that set him up for his life in the culinary world.
Yeah, his mother ran this epic boarding house, and it was the place where I guess everybody wanted to stay because her cooking was so amazing.
Exactly. It was called the Gladstone, and it was over on basically Yamhill and 13th in Southwest, where the freeway now goes through, and she prided herself as having some of the best food in Portland.
So give us a little bit of the narrative arc here. I mean, this was... He really kind of broke out in the 1950s. And in fact, a lot of people think that America's fascination with cooking got started with Julia Child and The French Chef. But James Beard had a TV show way back in the 1950s, years before Julia really made it big.
Yeah, actually 1946.
Oh, wow.
It was called I Love to Eat, and it was on NBC. And it was at a time when folks weren't even sure that television was going to make it. It was a new medium. Not very many people had TVs. They were usually in bars. It was usually men watching the Friday night fights. And his show was on before that. And he writes in his memoir that some of his friends who owned restaurants would call him up and say, you know, you're distracting my customers. They don't want to come out of the bar and go to their table because they want to watch the rest of your show. And he had really made it okay for men to be interested in cooking. And that was a very new thing at that time.
Yeah, that wasn't really part of the post-war culture, the way that people were socialized. And also, you know, Beard was promoting American cuisine at the time, which was a head scratcher back in the mid-century. I mean, if you were going out to dinner and it was a special occasion, you went French. It was all things French back then.
Exactly. French and Italian. And certainly when it came to wines, European wines, he was really quintessential in his work with the Four Seasons restaurant in New York City in 1959. He put American wines on the wine list, and that had never been seen before. So he really was always a champion of all things American, because we have such an incredible, diverse list of ingredients, and he just never understood why we needed to get our morels from France when, as he knew very well, Oregon has some of the best mushrooms in the world. And so finally, by the 70s, the rest of the country caught up to him.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of, ahead of its time, and sometimes that's really a curse. It wasn't until the 70s that American wines started winning awards, and people started paying attention to what was going on in their own landscape. Kind of a back to the land movement was starting about then.
Yes, exactly. It really was Alice Waters and folks like that that started to want to go back to that kind of home regional cooking that she had experienced in small villages in France. And again, you know, this is something that Beard had been writing about since the 40s. In all his books, he talked about find the best local ingredients, do very little to them, and you will have the most delicious meal.
You know, you mentioned Alice Waters, who makes an appearance in the film along with many other acolytes of Beard. And when she started Chez Panisse in Berkeley, I mean, it wasn't a trendy part of Berkeley. It was a sort of a back street, and they didn't have the money for foie gras. They didn't have the money for all of the things that fancy restaurants. So they would just cobble together what they could that week
yep.
from their suppliers, from the folks in the hills. And that became, you know, now, of course, that's the place to be, is Chez Panisse, the place to get a reservation. But back then, it was very sort of hippie. It was very bohemian.
Yep, that is very true. And they welcomed all people of all kinds. And it really was more like having dinner at somebody's house than it was going to a restaurant. And when James Beard went there, he fell in love with it, but he said, this isn't a real restaurant. And she knew what he meant, and she took that as a compliment.
Well, nobody in the kitchen was taught at the Cordon Bleu or anything like that. Some of them came in, they were mechanics, they were, you know, people in the community, but they just were really interested in the mission of this foodie movement, this local and sustainable foodie movement.
Absolutely. And it was one of the first places that the kitchen was open to the dining room, and you could see what was going on in the kitchen. Again, that's something that's become very trendy. You almost feel like they're hiding something if you can't see what everybody's doing. But that was very new and revolutionary at the time. So it really felt like you were at your nana's house or a friend's dinner party.
Now, one thing that was very traditional about James Beard was he was a true bon vivant. He was almost like a Victorian gentleman in the way that he kept company with everybody. He made the rounds. He was welcome at everybody's table. He pretty much never paid for a hotel room or a meal.
No, he did not. he was comped quite a bit. But as we all know, you know, that's wonderful, but it doesn't always pay your mortgage. So, he was a true freelancer. He did a little bit of everything to kind of hobble together a living. But I think that he thoroughly enjoyed it. He really didn't like to be alone. He was alone a lot as a child. His dad was pretty absent, and his mom was very close to him, but I think looked at him more as a social companion than a child.
Mm.
He went to parties and restaurants and bars that he should not have been in at the age of 10, 11, and 12. And so I think he had a very sophisticated upbringing, but maybe a little lonely sometimes. And so in his later life, he really didn't like to be alone much. So he loved to socialize and go out and invite people in, and his house was always busy.
Well, you, in the spirit of local and sustainable things, you put together a very indie, very local crew for this film. Greg Snyder did a bang-up job on the edit, and Marilyn Zernato put together some charming animated bumpers.
Absolutely. And
you're Seth all Portland people?
Portland people. Seth Lorinsky is our composer. He's another local person. Digital One did all of our sound mixing, and Mission Control helped us with our mastering. So we really kept it very local, and I can't thank all those folks enough, especially Greg. I mean, he's really one of the best editors in the country, and I was very lucky to have him here.
Well, it's a beautiful film, and would love to see more from you in the future. I hope this one's very popular.
Me too.
well, Beth Federici, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for swinging by today.
Yeah, thank you. And can we give a shout out? Yeah, it's going to be on American Masters May 19th at 9 p.m.
Yeah, May 19th at 9 p.m. And also, people can find out more at americasfirstfoodie.com. Is that correct?
Yes. And our Portland premiere is May 5th, which is actually James Beard's birthday, at the Witzel at the Portland Art Museum at 8 p.m. And you can get tickets tickets on the Art Museum, Northwest Film Center website, and we're super excited about that.
Well, thank you so much again, and it's great to have you here. You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. And now, let's join up with Jen, who has this month's film events calendar.
Here's a few film events coming up in the next month. Kicking off tonight, the 27th, and continuing through April 30th, the Overlook Film Festival celebrates horror film at the iconic Timberline Lodge, where The Shining was filmed. They'll present over 36 films, features and shorts ranging from classic to contemporary, with world premieres in the horror and thriller genres, including the film Stephanie on opening night. Details at overlookfilmfest.org. From May 10th through the 14th, the Hollywood Theater will be home to the 2017 Northwest Animation Festival. This fest offers a slew of short animated films from around the globe selected from over 1,100 submissions. It'll also feature filmmaker talks, interactive animation, after parties, and more. More info at nwanimationfest.org. On Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m., KBOO continues our own film series at the Clinton Street Theater with the screening of Plant This Movie. The documentary explores urban farming around the globe. Details at cstpdx.com or at our website, kboo.fm. And on Friday, May 12th, the Clinton Street Theater will present the latest installment of Northwest Documentary's Homegrown DocFest at 7 p.m. This recurring fest showcases new documentary shorts by students of Northwest Doc's filmmaking workshops. More info at nwdocumentary.org. On Thursday, May 25th, Portland filmmaker Carl Diehl will present a program of his video work entitled Electronic Elsewhere at the Northwest Film Center at 7 p.m. A founding member of the audiovisual group Weird Fiction, he'll present 3 experimental works from the last decade. Details at nwfilm.org. From May 26th through the 29th, the Vanport Mosaic Festival will explore the history and legacy of Vanport, a diverse World War II-era housing project in the Portland area wiped out by a flood. The festival will include screenings of oral history projects about Vanport, as well as other documentary screenings. Events will take place at locations throughout North Portland. More info at vanportmosaic.org. On Wednesday, May 31st, the Northwest Film Center presents An Evening with Nature documentarian Kathy Kasich. While an artist in residence at Montana's Tippett Rise Art Center, she collaborated with musicians who played concerts there to create a collection of short films on the art ranch. She'll present a program of those films at 7 p.m. and take questions after the screening. More info at nwfilm.org. And that about wraps it up. Thanks and have a good month, everybody.
Thank you, Jen, and thanks to all our guests today, Lindsay Grazel and Dea Schlossberg, Eric Slade, and Beth Federici. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration, and thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at KBOO Film Show. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
In the dream.